with Scott Allen.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in this beautiful world. I am your host, Scott J. Allen, and this is Phronesis, Practical Wisdom for Leaders. Now, I am a professor of management at John Carroll University in Cleveland, Ohio, USA. In addition, I'm a husband and father of three teens. Now, this is a family endeavor. Will played the intro, Kate voiced the intro, and who knows, you may hear from Emily a little later. I'm also an author, entrepreneur, speaker, and co-founder of the Collegiate Leadership Competition. I love to travel, explore new places with family, and learn from others. Phronesis offers a smart, fast-paced discussion about all things leadership and followership, if we're honest. My guests are scholars and practitioners, and we cover relevant topics and incorporate practical tips designed to help you make a difference in how you lead and live. I am proud to share a few updates. According to Listen Notes, Phronesis is listed as among the top 3% of podcasts in the world because of you. So thank you. In addition, the podcast has two sponsors. First, Phronesis is the official podcast of the International Leadership Association, an association that is near and dear to my heart. ILA brings together leaders and those who teach, study, and develop leadership, advancing leadership knowledge and practice for a better world. Learn more at ila-net.org. My second sponsor is the Bowler College of Business at John Carroll University. At Bowler, we offer several advanced degrees and MBAs, and I'm confident that there's one that will fit your location, interests, and timeline. In fact, our online MBA is ranked as the number one in Ohio and number nine in the United States. We offer international study tours, a contemporary and forward-looking curriculum, and access to senior leaders and flagship organizations. Learn more at business.jcu.edu. You can find links to both sponsors in the show notes. Now, if you like what we're up to, please hit subscribe so you can stay current as we release new episodes each week. You can also share what we're up to with others, friends, colleagues, leaders, teams, students, and others you think will benefit. And now, today's show. Okay, everybody, welcome to the Phronesis podcast. Thank you so much for checking in wherever you are in the world. Today, I have Dr. Peter Ray, and he is Vice President of Integrity and Ethics at Parker Hannifin Corporation. He is a professor of business administration at Baldwin Wallace University. He teaches physician leadership for the Cleveland Clinic, and he chairs Ohio University's Medical School Advisory Board. Parker Hannifin is a Fortune 250 publicly owned company with annual sales over $19 billion, employing about 65,000 teammates in 50 countries. Parker is the global leader in motion and control technologies. In 2012, Peter joined Parker in a newly established position with the purpose of preserving Parker's reputation and protecting its financial strength. The mission is to help individuals and teams perform at high levels despite pressure and uncertainty guided by character defined as virtue. The strategy is to understand and apply a strength-based approach to support existing business priorities. The business impact of the virtues has been increased engagement, enhanced teamwork, and leadership development. Previously, Peter was business dean and founding Burton D. Morgan Chair Entrepreneurial Studies at Baldwin Wallace University. He was a founding director of Baldwin Wallace's Center for Innovation and Growth. The center provides a practical forum for students, profit and nonprofit senior leaders and entrepreneurs to create economic and social value through innovation guided by integrity. He holds a PhD from the University of Akron, an MA from Bowling Green State University, and a BS from Ohio University. My wife is a double bobcat, by the way.
Well, there you go. You married up.
He has completed postdoctoral studies in international marketing and finance and marketing strategy at the University of South Carolina, Memphis University, Carnegie Mellon University, and Duke University. Publications include Better Humans, Better Performance, December 2022. And this book is an extension of Exception to the Rule, The Surprising Science of Character-Based Culture and Performance, co-authored with Alan Culp and Dr. Jamie Stoller. He co-authored Igniting Innovation and With Integrity with Alan Culp and Pierre Everart, 2011. And he co-authored Integrity is a Growth Market and Leading with Integrity with Alan Culp in 2005. You know what, sir? It is a pleasure to have you with me today. Thank you so very much for stopping by. You know, I have the perfect place from that bio that I want to start at. And it goes a little bit like this: better humans, better performance. Let's talk about that. Better humans, better performance. What do you think?
I don't know that I understood this completely till you dive into the research and then start to actually put it into practice, that it's true that the so-called soft stuff, character defined by virtue, leads to better performance. But maybe it's not so surprising once that we understand that the word virtue means excellence, and once we know that it's not a virtue until I act, so that you can start to see an overlap, a Venn diagram between character defined by virtue and high performance.
Well, and talk about how, because you've made this transition. I mean, it's a beautiful transition from kind of a career in academia to actually putting all of this into action in a Fortune 250. Would you take us along that journey, if you would, maybe from the beginning and kind of how that path has played out and what you've learned as some of this theory has interfaced with the real world in 50 countries, literally the world, right?
Yeah, I'm trying to keep this brief. So I think that my background's in strategy, and that when I was younger, I did used to think that being right was enough, that all you needed to do was figure out the competitive advantage and you were good to go. And then the older I got, it's the conclusion. I was slow to figure this out. I wish I'd have understood it earlier in my career, that the so-called soft stuff, culture, teamwork, leadership, that's where the action is. So you get two teams, one team, brilliant people, brilliant strategy, egomaniacs that can't get out of their own way. And they're going up against team B, where the strategy is not bad. People are reasonably bright, but oh my gosh, can they function effectively as a team? And B takes out A all the time. So it's the missing piece for me was this culture stuff. And Baldwin Wallace, like John Carroll, has a tradition of the liberal arts. And historically, what it meant to be liberally educated is to understand and practice virtue. And I like the ideas that are old as dirt. I'm old, and I like stuff that stood the test of time. But, you know, what a lot of the concepts I love about character can be a bit abstract. So then how do you take those ideas and apply them in a practical way into business? So just to fast forward quickly, I started kind of tying together the culture defined by virtues. Think culture, teamwork, leadership, foundationally, how do all those excel by virtue? And was doing that at Baldwin Wallace, the Center for Innovation and Growth. And you will appreciate this, Scott, given your role at John Carroll. You know, if you're a full prof, you're tenured, and you're an endowed chair, life is good. I mean, it's a wonderful life. And I had a lot of friends that were saying, you're nuts to eat that and go to a Fortune 250 company. And it actually did take both Parker and me quite a while to sort that out. Did it make any sense? So I would just put it this way, that when I got to this tipping point of, okay, would I regret not doing this? This company is saying, bring your life's work, and you got 50 countries and 350 locations, have at it.
Yeah.
Would I regret not doing that? And I concluded, yeah, I would. Because this is what I've been whining about, that ethics was limited to the definition of compliance. You need compliance. You can debate whether we have too much or too little. But the opportunity was, you know, if you're practicing virtue, you're helping yourself on the downside and the upside, meaning mitigate risk and promoting growth. So I conclude with this is not only do I have no regrets about making the move, this has been better than I ever expected.
So you get there and it's day one. And how have you been building? Talk about that process. And then maybe let's go through some of the results and observations that you've had, some of the learning also. So talk about what you started building.
Right. So the endowed chair I held was an entrepreneurship. So I treated this like an internal startup.
Yeah.
The first thing you do is voice of the customer. And the beautiful part of this, I report to the chief financial officer. So the argument was, how do you protect the balance sheet? Our culture is our greatest asset. So what's your on-purpose plan? And I was given enough time to think this through that I'm incredibly grateful. So the voice of the customer was a piece of that puzzle. And I think what I learned from that was you would talk to people about what I've just said. Our culture is our greatest asset. You need an on-purpose plan. Okay, I get that. So what does that mean? Well, there's this character stuff defined by virtue. They're universal. They cut across time. They cut across borders. It means excellence. So that's the what of how we can figure out how to practice it. All right, sounds fine. So how the hell are you going to do it? kind of move pretty quickly from the why and the what made sense, but the how was much trickier. And I think, you know, the other kind of takeaway from all those interviews that I remember very clearly is, look, pal, Parker doesn't need one more program. So what it took from that then is, how do you integrate the virtues into daily practice, into existing initiatives, which I think makes more sense anyway to approach it that way rather than a standalone. So that was basically the way it got started. And then there was dumb luck. Again, back to better to be lucky than good. I had several friends who worked at Parker, stumbled into one in the cafeteria. He stared at me and said, what the hell are you doing here? He knew me from being a professor. Explained it. He said, you know what? I think our group president would be interested in this. So that moved from the voice of the customer to the pilot. At the time, this little sample or pilot was $1.3 billion in revenue, 14 divisions, all with separate P&L.
This little pilot?
Took about a year and a half to get
for your little startup.
Exactly. But what was intriguing about it is we did the pre and post test, at least at a high level. And pre, the engagement scores for this group were the worst. And the financial results were about middle of the pack. Post, the engagement scores were at the top of the company, and so were the financial results. So from an engagement point of view, it was kind of a worst to first. And to be clear, I think you can draw a pretty straight line between practicing virtue and engagement. I'm not as confident about the financial returns. I think it doesn't hurt, but there's way, way too many variables, I think, to kind of argue that you're going to get better margins, growth rates, all that. But you can lay a foundation for those kind of things to occur. And then it kind of took off after that.
So Peter, take me through a little bit, because I love the kind of notion of, let's have this move in kind of the flow of the work, the direction of the work. We don't need another program. What were some components of the intervention, so to speak, so that listeners have a sense of how did you do the work with these teams?
Yeah. So, and I think hopefully I've gotten even better at what I'm going to say. I don't know that I was as tight as the way I'm going to describe it now at the beginning. So I think what we're pretty good at now is you always start with existing strategies, existing priorities, existing activities. And so you're not kind of introducing new concepts in that sense. And I suggest that you've got a culture anyway. It's just, do you want to be intentional about it? Or does it just kind of grow? And that's the riskier one, of course. You don't need to convince anybody that culture is not only going to eat strategy for breakfast, it's going to eat process for lunch, and it's going to eat metrics for dinner.
That I haven't heard that one before. Say that one
brutal.
Again. Say
yeah.
that one again. It's hungry. It sounds like this is hungry.
It'll eat strategy for breakfast, process for lunch, and metrics for dinner. And it's, you know, we all kind of know that culture is this huge performance amplifier or break.
Yes.
And then the hard part is you're up here, you're really, really clear about your strategy. And, you know, Parker's engineers backed up by accountants. So, I mean, we're as metric driven as anybody, and we know precisely where we are at a point in time. But then how do you kind of draw a line from culture to drive all those results that you want? That part's not as obvious.
Yeah.
So the place to begin is this existing priorities. The second part that's really, really important is you need a common language, precisely because culture, teamwork, and leadership, for that matter, are so abstract. It's kind of alphabet soup, as you know from your background.
Sure.
And then you're kind of, well, you know, who's this author saying? What's this theory say? And it's kind of makes your head numb. Where if you can remember seven words, there you go. That's what excellence looks like. So at a pragmatic level, what has gone well, I've used this for a long time, is you have teams just arbitrarily come to the session with their answers to three questions on one virtue, and then you just rotate it to the other. So for trust, what's trust? Why should I give a flip? How do you strengthen trust?
Wow.
What you're doing is you're building common language. And I don't know how else you would do this without that as your foundational piece.
Yeah. So we're creating this common language and weaving it into the culture of how we exist. It's these seven things. For listeners, would you take us through the seven again? So we've got trust. And what
trust, compassion, courage, justice, wisdom, temperance, hope.
Okay.
And those are known as the seven classical virtues. I've nuanced a couple of them. And classical means these virtues cut across time and they cut across borders. And that's important because we're in 50 countries. So it can't be a U.S.-centric approach.
Sure. So we're elevating dialogue and creating a common language. We're aligning it with a strategy. Are there other pieces of the intervention that you found to be helpful? Because I like how you're thinking about this. We're kind of anchoring it and weaving it into the system versus it being a standalone over here, quote unquote. What other aspects should listeners know about?
So the really critical piece, once you've got the common language, you've integrated into existing priorities, is habits.
Hmm.
What's tough about the virtues is when they're needed most are when they're the hardest to practice during periods of stress and pressure and adversity. No one's going to be against these ideas where you're really, what I'd like to do is work for a team where everybody doesn't trust each other. They don't give a flip about each other.
Really, we want unfair. No hope. We want no hope.
Driven by despair. Where do I get this job? So everybody wants this stuff. We all want to work for a team where we trust each other, care for each other. We're courageous and full of hope, realistic hope, I might add. But then the hard part is how do you practice it? So it starts to implicate tools like coaching. Deliberate practice and what we know about habits, that we're all a mixed bag of healthy and unhealthy habits. And so what do we know about trying to create these new habits or strengthen existing habits so that you can get the results that we're all interested in? It's a reminder, I think, of two factors. It's not a virtue until I act. And there's a knucklehead inside every one of us. So we're all going to screw this up. I just want the trend line to be favorable. That's about all I can hope for.
Well, I love that phrasing because I think some of the Carol Dweck of mindset fame from Stanford, she says, becoming is better than being, right?
Right.
And there's this great quote by Bob Hogan, who you are is how you lead, right? So,
yeah.
Okay.
Right.
So here we are. And as you said, we are all these mixed bags. Every one of us have great strengths and areas of growth, areas for improvement for sure. But for me, are we becoming? Are we in this constant process of trying to be better, trying to practice the virtues, and at least present and intentional in that work, right? I think you used the word deliberate practice. So critical, right?
Yeah, it is. It's a good quote. Who you are is how you lead. Who you are is how you show up on a team. Who you are is how you parent. So that's the part that I think often gets skipped over as the focus tends to be more on competencies. As opposed to character, it's not that competencies are essential. They're kind of table stakes. I mean, do you know what the hell you're doing? And if not, then that's not going to go well. Nobody's against character, but it's ill-defined. So we're kind of morally inarticulate. And if I've just got stuff on a wall about integrity, I mean, every sports team's got this stuff in a locker room. And some coaches are really quite good at operationalizing it. And it changed the way the team functions. I'm not being critical of the one that's got it on the wall. It's not so obvious. How do you operationalize these ideas?
Yeah. Any other kind of clues that you've stumbled upon as to how to operationalize these so that they do become part of the culture, our way of being, and we have people deliberately practicing because they have this beautiful practice field each and every day. It's called work, and it's also called home. But bringing humans to a place of looking at their workday or looking at their home life as an opportunity to practice, that's a challenge at times.
It's very hard. There's a gazillion examples. This is one. So being strength-based is a good methodology. You know, the jargon term, as you're well aware of, is the appreciative inquiry. But, you know, business people don't tend to use that language. Being strength-based resonates a little bit better. And that can be misunderstood, that being strength-based doesn't mean ignoring weaknesses. That's narcissism. It means that let's leverage your strengths. So how do we do that? I'll give two examples. One is in terms of performance evaluations, there's not a lot of good evidence that they work. Let's start with that.
Yeah.
That we're actually much better at helping someone be successful than we are at judging them. We kind of stink at that part of it. So what if we ask two questions as part of the performance evaluation? What do you do well? And how could you do more of it? And the evidence is you get these jumps. You actually only need it at the margins, about 10 to 15% more of your time on your strengths. And you get these huge jumps in engagement. Because to go from I suck at something to mediocrity is not exactly a winning formula. But if you can leverage your strengths while acknowledging your weakness, that ups your game. That's one. The other is most organizations anymore are metric driven. And so you're going to do that anyway. And the organization, well, this comes from a good place. They'll look at the red results and say, well, that's where we start. Who's got responsibility for this? What are we going to do about it? We need accountability. It's understandable why that starts, but where you could flip it, let's look at the green results. What do we do well there that we can attack the red with a vengeance? And you're not going to get green results with the antithesis of virtue. You're going to get it because it's present. So you start to show firsthand as we do our work, the more we're practicing these things, we get better results. And some of this stuff is, I don't go crazy over this, and I'm certainly no, I'm not a neurologist, but I think a lot, half the time we're battling this lizard brain. So it's, you're battling fear of failure, or I'm fearful of how I'm going to be seen by my colleagues, or I'm fearful that I'm going to lose my job. And the prefrontal cortex shuts down and you get crap performance. So it's this balancing act between, on the one hand, you do need the psychological safety to step in to get the motivation and accountability for results. And we've both seen a gazillion studies that basically show relationships first, performance second, and the order matters. I think too often it gets stuck where it's either over here and it's warm and fuzzy and lovely, but at some point you got to perform.
Yes.
And over here, it's kind of suck it up, buttercup. And that doesn't help us either. You kind of need that foundational piece. So it's not an either or argument. It's investing in the relationships and getting good performance.
Yeah. It's the Blake and Mouton, right? Wasn't that, you know, that high. We're going for the process and the people, and kind of that golden mean is a little bit different for probably every individual, right?
Right.
Oh, wow. Now, talk about some of the results that you've experienced. I mean, because this is pretty fascinating. I mean, because again, you've got the engineers, you've got the accountants. They're looking to you like, okay, how's this
working out?
Where's
your staking data? Yeah. You're not allowed to talk until you got your numbers. The initial, you know, of course, everybody starts with this question, how will you measure success? And that came early and often. And the CFO who recruited me was wonderful about this. And we talked a lot about this before we started. Let's distinguish between compliance as part of the ethics program that you have to do. It's a push strategy. And let's define character in terms of a pull strategy. You want to do it. So one's tapping on an extrinsic motivation and the other on intrinsic motivation. So we agreed that, in fact, we separated kind of approach to compliance and character for that reason. We kind of did that early on. You need compliance. I don't want to be misunderstood on this point.
Yep.
And if you're publicly owned, you don't have a choice anyway. You have got to do this stuff. And there's no organization that's perfect. So whether it's John Carroll or every, there's always ethical lapses. So you've got to do it.
Just add humans, right? Just
exactly.
Add humans. It gets pretty interesting.
Happen. I think that, you know, the difference is not there isn't going to be an ethical breach, but how do you respond is actually, I think, the more interesting question. So if we're going to go to the other side, it's a pull strategy, then the first metric was, does your phone ring? These are busy P&L owners. They're not going to do it unless they see value. And so if your phone isn't ringing, you're not doing jack. There's no value to be added. So we kept it that simple. Does your phone ring that people who don't have to work for you or with you believe there's sufficient value to put a group of people in a room, which is incredibly expensive when you start adding up everybody's salary, and say, hey, this is worth our trouble. So that's how we started it. Then the kind of little pilot I shared with you said, well, okay, well, wait a minute. Looks like we're getting a jump in engagement. What if we got intentional and look a little harder at engagement and do an experimental design, pre-post control treatment, randomization? And I'm compressing here several years, Scott. I don't, this is not where we started, but we did get to the place where we were running studies internally and we're seeing jumps of 10 to 20% year over year on engagement scores. Not as a quick fix. I want to be clear. This isn't snap your fingers, do a little virtue for a day and you're solid. But if it's played out over a 9 to 12 month period and you've got committed leaders and all the things that any change requires, that's been kind of remarkable. It's evolved to more kind of the engagement. And you see some jumps in finance, but I'm kind of leery about making that argument that virtue is going to get you better margins.
But, you know, I mean, you can get into some interesting conversations, too, about the cost of engagement or the lack of engagement, right? I mean, you can,
right.
And of course, that's going to be a little bit all over the board, but there's a huge bottom line benefit to engagement, whether that's turnover, whether that's productivity, right? I mean, have you explored, you know, I'm not asking you to share specific numbers, but have you all explored all aspects of the benefits of engagement?
Yeah, without a doubt. What I'm going to describe is public information. So we have what many others would call a scorecard. And ours is called the WIN strategy. And so it's intentionally laid out as engage people, customer experience, profitable growth, and financial returns. And it's to be read left to right. So that your foundational piece is engagement.
Wow.
You know, basically you're in control of the first two pillars. Do a good job taking care of each other. Do a good job taking care of your customers. And then if those are the leading indicators. The lagging indicators is you grow faster than the market and you have good financial returns. So I think it does, yes, it does spill over that. Or if you put it the other way, good luck trying to get financial results with disengaged teammates.
It doesn't work. So, Peter, I'm really interested in knowing this as you kind of reflect on, I mean, how many years has it been that you've been internal? I have it on your bio, but I'm not remembering it. Is it 12?
11.
Okay, 11
yeah,
years.
11 years.
So what has surprised you about the work?
Yeah, it's a good question, Scott. So, you know, when you're involved in strategy, innovation, entrepreneurship, you expect pushback that, you know, for good or for bad, perhaps a character flaw is interested in disruption. And the older you get, you just realize expect the blowback. And so I expected that.
Yeah.
And it didn't happen. That's what surprised me. I mean, they're just, it's been pretty quick around, we want to lead this way. We want to live this way. And by the way, I think the key is making clear that there are performance benefits of practicing it. And then if you can offer, I often get asked, hey, this is great for the company. Do you have any thoughts or ideas about applying it to kids? And so that's the other kind of key piece to it is giving people the opportunity to say, well, here's the content, here's the evidence. What works for you? Do you want to apply it at home? Do you want to apply it to your leadership? Do you want to apply it to your team? So my direct answer to your question, I would have guessed there would have been more pushback than there's been. And, you know, and I might add, I think the private sector, I think it's easier to do it than it would be in a university.
Really?
You would think otherwise, but I think it'd be tough to do it. You can do it pockets of it in a university, and you would think liberal arts schools would be good at this, and it's not to suggest there aren't components of it. But in terms of higher ed, this the sector that I see doing it really well, nothing's perfect, are the service academies.
Yeah.
Where there's an intentionality about character, it's clearly defined, it's, they're baking. A lot of the ideas, I'm not a military person. They wouldn't have had me, and I'm not sure I'd have been interested. But you know, when you start swapping data and insights, I've learned more from the military than any other organization I've shared ideas with.
Yes. And I need to connect you with Doug Lindsay at the Journal of Character and Leadership Development, because he would love to connect with you, because that is their space. They are into this topic of character and how do we build people of character and that formation. I mean, it's so admirable. You know, you're steeped in the research, you're steeped in the strategy, the entrepreneurship, all of that. And then you actually get into the organization, you put it into action, you build. And I mean, what a wonderful place to experiment and learn in just a little bit of a different way, right?
Right. Yeah, I'd love to meet your colleague. And I guess I hadn't thought about it. Your question about what surprised me. I don't know that, I mean, I was familiar with what the military did with character education before I joined, but until I started going to West Point Naval Academy and all that and seeing firsthand when you look under the covers and or Navy SEALs, I came away just, wow, this, the intentionality of this is pretty inspiring. And it's, again, I don't think any of them would claim they're perfect at it. And there's plenty of examples where they got screw ups. I like their candor, actually. It's not that they don't hide things. I'm not suggesting there aren't perfections here, but I think overall, I'm kind of intrigued that like restorative justice, what they do in the service academies around that, that I think a lot of organizations could benefit from that. And there's a mercenary argument for it. How do we retain these freaking expensive cadets who, if we do it right on restorative justice and it's rigorous, you actually end up with some really good officers when you're done with that.
Yeah.
So that's the piece that I don't know that I would have had full appreciation for what the military has to teach other sectors, recognizing they're not perfect. I don't know that I would have understood that without working with Parker.
Well, I just finished Jocko Willink's Extreme Ownership. I don't know if you've had a chance to read that book. Have you?
Yeah, I have. Uh-huh.
Yeah, have you read the next one, The Dichotomies of Leadership?
Nope, I haven't.
So super interesting here, Peter. I mean, I was listening to Jocko's book and his co-author, and I really, really enjoyed it, right? I mean, it's an N of one, it's or two, I should say. It's their lived experience and kind of their principles that they've put into action. So it's not like it's rigorous from an academic standpoint, but certainly captivating in the stories, the principles, and then how those principles can be relayed to business. Well, what's interesting is in the second book, at least in the version of the audiobook I listened to, they gave us one chapter in the new book. And they spend the first part kind of dissecting what didn't go well with the first book, how it was misinterpreted, what they learned once it kind of interfaced with the public, what they learned about some of the flaws. And Jocko even says, look, the name Extreme Ownership, we don't necessarily think was the right message because we don't always need extreme ownership. I mean, it's on a spectrum. So it was even as if he was doing an after action review on the previous work. And then of course, iterating, but iterating in public in a really, really nice way, right? Almost
impressive.
Modeling, right? Almost modeling that after action review and that hard look within as we move forward and better understand the phenomenon. So if you have a chance, check that out. The second book
is
The Dichotomies of Leadership. And, you know, again, really, I think I did some work with a sound engineering company once. They had one of the largest set of the certain type of speaker in the world, and they had all these soundboards. And it was really, really an interesting experience. I promise this is going somewhere. But I looked at the soundboard and it made me think of leadership, right? I mean, I said to them, when you get into certain outdoor arenas or a stadium, or maybe you're in Madison Square Garden, all of these dials, depending on the context, have to shift and adjust to fit this new context. And they were like, yes. And I said, well, leadership is in many ways the same way. It's just, are you being a little more altruistic or a little bit less altruistic? Are you being a little more assertive or are you being less assertive in your style and more democratic in your style? And are you intentional about some of those adjustments that are occurring given the situation? So it was interesting because I appreciated the fact that A, they were reflecting and that B, their own thinking about the topic is evolving and they're open about it, right?
That's very impressive. And I like the idea of it being a dichotomy. I mean, when I think about if you switch to the corporate side, there's a dichotomy between, on the one hand, you have to create value.
Mm-hmm.
And on the other hand, you have to extract value. and that's not easy to do.
Yes. At the same organization, on a break, I was talking about leadership. And a gentleman, they had locations in the UK and Australia and the United States, and their people would go out all around the world. I had a gentleman come up and in a British accent say, every aspect of what you just discussed about leadership, my mentor exhibited in this British accent. And I said, oh, well, who is your mentor? And he said, David Bowie. I'm glad to know that Ziggy Stardust was a good guy.
Well, you know, to your point, I think there's a lot you can learn from the arts.
Yes.
You know, the level of vulnerability of putting yourself out there with your song or your music or your acting with no assurance that this is going to go well for you. It's really a remarkable act of courage.
It is.
And of course, it's an interesting comment, thought process. Say, well, what could we learn from that? I don't want to be a musician, but well, anybody who's trying to create something, it's an act of vulnerability. It's an act of courage. You don't know how it's going to work out. You need teams. So all those kinds of things. There was Baldwin has a very good conservatory, and there was a conductor I got to know pretty well. I hadn't heard this term applied to music. He said the musician improves once they make the empathy shift. And what he meant by that is, say I play the violin and I'm technically capable, but all I do is hear myself play it. And the empathy shift is you can now hear everybody in the orchestra play. And when you do that, your game goes up. And he's listening for it, of whether the student will be able to make the empathy shift. If they can't, they will be suboptimizing their performance.
Huh. Well, I mean, think about that with leadership.
Exactly.
Right? I mean, yes. Well, okay. We've talked a little bit about a couple of books and maybe some things out there, but what's caught your attention recently? What have you been listening to? What have you been streaming? As we begin to wind down, I always ask guests this. So, you know, it could have something to do with something we've just discussed, or it could be just a television show that's caught your eye recently. What's been on your radar?
I think the piece that I'm focused on is navigating uncertainty.
Mm.
That perceived or real, you got a lot of people that are full of angst. And, you know, you see the bleak side is kind of deaths of despair, kind of people being angry with one another or sad. And all those numbers are not in the direction you want. So that's taken to an extreme. But even people who are kind of moving through the day, how do I deal with uncertainty? And at one level, you'd say, well, is this the most uncertain period of time? I mean, there was this thing called World War II. That was pretty uncertain. Great Depression, yes. Not bad. World War I, yeah, you'd have to give it a vote.
Spanish flu.
Yep, exactly. In some ways, it doesn't matter. I mean, it's just this kind of relative experience of how do I make sense of uncertainty? So at least what the research shows, I've been doing a lot in this area. So who are these people who seem to do a better job handling uncertainty than the rest of us? And the pillars are identity, relationships, and purpose. And the identity takes you back to character and virtue. That's what's preeminent. It has an outsized impact on my ability to handle uncertainty because it's about living by conviction and not by circumstance, which the Stoics taught us a gazillion years ago.
Yep.
So in that sense, it's not new, but it takes you back to how do you practice it, all the things we've been discussing. Then when you look at all the research on relationships, whether, you know, like the Google study, how people treat each other is a better predictor of performance than who's on the team. I mean, it just goes on and on and on that the relationship is key and the performance follows. Or if you take it on the personal side, the Harvard study that's 85 years old, and there's other studies that haven't gone as long as, you know, who are these people that live life well, live life long? And the number one predictor is quality of relationships.
Yep.
It's one of those kind of duh, do we live that way? And the last one is purpose. And purpose being defined by commit my life to something bigger than myself. I think the only kind of challenge with purpose is it can get a bit abstract. Like, you know, where do I find my purpose? Do I need a better flashlight or do I just sit on the couch and I wait for a lightning bolt to hit me? And, you know, maybe a more pragmatic question is either A, what does this time require of me? Or B, what can I do to be more useful? And so those pillars, when they all can be learned and I'm in control of all three, I can't control other people's relationships to me, but I can control how I invest in relationships. And the consequences, we come out a little more sturdy and a little more resilient. In the absence of those three, we're more fragile.
So that's what you've been exploring.
That's it. I think it's a big deal. I see it everywhere, not just in Parker, but it's just, you know, how do we help people or a kid? I worry about a generation of kids, and you do this with all of your important work at a university. You see, you know, one level, have college students always been a little flipped out about going through the experience of being a student? Yeah, I'm sure. But you look at some of the numbers of how students are kind of dealing with it. Rather than kind of saying, hey, put me in the game, coach, this learning is dynamite, I'm all in, versus, oh my gosh, I'm full of anxiety, I'm full of concern. And, you know, from a performance point of view, when anxiety goes up, performance declines. So even if we're mercenary about this, how do we kind of, we're not going to eliminate the angst, but trying to give people tools to deal with anxiety, stress, pressure. You know, that's what I also see with professional athletes is they're given tools to deal with this stuff because a lot of them are also struggle with life. They're young. I mean,
yes.
One comment and then take this where it's useful. I've done a fair amount with professional athletics. And one leader said, look, have you ever had your picture and performance on a scoreboard and what you've done over the last week? And tens of thousands of people are there watching that. and millions on TV. When was the last time that happened to you? Screw up. Nobody knows about it. The whole freaking world knows about it.
Exactly. So,
yeah, how do you help somebody who's 23, 24, 25 deal with that level of pressure?
Yes.
And it's learned. It can be learned. That's the optimistic piece.
Yes. But it's a whole different context of reality when that's your lived reality. That's the average is up there, good, bad, or ugly. In really big font.
Yeah, which and your face is the biggest part.
Often not a good picture of you either.
No, it's all bad.
Well, Peter, thank you so much for spending some time today. Thank you for your good work. Love to have you back and keep the conversation going. Thanks so much. Just really, really appreciate your time.
I appreciate the invitation, Scott. Thanks for the conversation.
Maybe, just maybe, it's as simple as better humans, better performance. And longtime listeners will know that I love that Peter has an opportunity to practice and to really, really learn in an organization. To take that hypothesis, better humans, better performance, and test it out and really work to develop individuals in that organization. And let's see what happens. What happens to the return on investment for doing that work? And it sounds like we have an individual here who is engaged and immersed in that work. Peter, can't thank you enough for your time. Can't thank you enough for that conversation. I just really, really enjoyed the conversation. And I do wonder, is it that simple? Better human, better performance. Practical wisdom for me. What are some of those hypotheses that you have, and what are you doing to test them in your organization to learn and see if we can get further, see if we can have a greater impact, see if we can make a difference in the lives of others? Take care. Thanks, everyone, as always, for checking in. Peter, thank you for your good work. Bye-bye.
You have just finished another episode of Practical Wisdom for Leaders with Scott Allen. To contact me, visit www.scottjallen.net or send me a note at scott@scottjallen.net. I can also be found on Twitter and LinkedIn, so let's connect. Now, if you have feedback, I'd love to hear it. And as always, thank you so much for listening. One final nod to our sponsors, the International Leadership Association and the Bowler College of Business at John Carroll University. And now, here's Kate's twin sister, Emily, with the outro.
You've been listening to Phronesis, Practical Wisdom with Scott Allen.